The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
We begin with some important primary election results, including a major victory for supporters of abortion rights. They celebrated in Kansas last night after voters rejected a move to remove abortion right protections from the state's constitution. Voters rejected the measure put forth by Republican legislators, nearly 60 to 40%.
President Biden says this makes clear that a majority of Americans support access to abortion. Still, the results were a surprise here in Kansas because this is a conservative state. But turnout here was huge, which suggests that both Republicans and Democrats support access to abortion.
I feel like my state just showed up and boldly told me that they are going to take care of me.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that's really telling, isn't it? I was surprised at the outcome of that Kansas decision, but you heard at the very end of that clip an abortioner saying, "My state just boldly showed up and told me that they're going to take care of me." What a thought, right? What a thought. I don't put my faith in the state. Right? It's to me, I don't view it as a benevolent provider and protector. It'd be nice if I could have that view. I mean, God is that for me, but you know, abortion and the culture of death, the ability to kill a child, has been unfortunately upheld in Kansas. And let's say a prayer for that state. But yeah, it's telling. I sit back here and I think, what does this portend for the midterms? And how does this play out? I really didn't think, look, it's a talking point for the Democratic Party, the culture of death. They love to champion this particular theme. Planned Parenthood had an unbelievable outpouring of funding into their organization after the Dobbs decision. Both was leaked and Roe overturned. But I thought, is it really going to motivate people to the polls? Well, it may. I could be off on that one. I thought, not really. But yeah, maybe it's, you know, voters were out at the polls in a number of states yesterday. I don't know if you're following any politics yet. Kansas was one of those states where they were voting on whether to amend their state's constitution, overturn it was a 2019 state Supreme Court ruling, like the U.S. Supreme Court did in 1973. They found abortion somewhere, you know, in the Constitution. Sunflower State did the same thing. Well, the value, it was called the Value Them Both Amendment. This particular amendment would have made it clear that abortion isn't in that document, right? It's just not there. But unfortunately, the opposition against the proposal was strong, and here's the thing. You know, they were outspent. The culture of death poured in money, and they outspent their proponents 6-1. They filled the airwaves with all these half-truths and these lies about what it would do. Michael New, who's been a regular contributor on this radio program, he's from the Charlotte Lozier Institute. He's a scholar there. I was going to put him on the air today. I figured I'm not going to belabor this point. I'm just going to call you to pray for it. He says, you know, that the change was probably too abrupt, that it could, you know, easily be demonized by the opposition. And that's why this fell 61-39. It wasn't super close, but it's really unfortunate. It was saddening to me. It was one of those pieces of news that sometimes I don't even like to deliver to you. I just don't like it, but let's pray. I'll give you a prophecy. I'll give you a prediction. I'll give you my own personal view of what's going to happen in the future. Abortion in this country one day will be gone in every single state. It'll be gone. We will be a nation one day in which life is upheld from the moment of conception through natural death. Why do I say that? Because death feeds upon itself. Death and the culture of death can never stand. It always collapses. Classic examples, 1531, when the Mother of God came and vanquished, you know, the human sacrifice of the Aztecs. We're no different than the Aztecs right now. A mighty empire, we're a mighty empire, mighty country. What will bring it about? I don't know. It might be a slow process, as you know, it took a half a century to get rid of Roe. But with people like you, people like me, with our prayers, I know that can be expedited, and I'm confident that my children and their children and their children will one day hopefully live in a country where life is respected. But I got to be honest with you, these pro-abortion, you know, the pro-abortion opposition was certainly scared of this amendment. I mean, the possibility that it could pass. So it's Students for Life, some of their members, they were out canvassing for votes just in favor of the amendment. One of those was this girl named Grace Hartsock, H-A-R-T-S-O-C-K, Hartsock. And she was turning to leave a house when she heard yelling and she heard cursing from inside the house. And a woman came running out of the house of Grace and started pushing her, beating her, and hitting her with her fist. And fortunately, Grace was okay, but obviously, that woman was and is seriously disturbed. She needs our prayers. Here's a little audio from Grace Hartsock herself. This comes from an interview she did on Fox along with Kristen Hawkins, the president of Student for Life.
So I was in Kansas with Students for Life Action, door knocking in support of the Values in Both Amendment. And I knocked on a door that afternoon, just as I had about 100 times already. I introduced myself to the woman who answered. I told her I was volunteering in favor of the amendment. I asked if I could count on her to vote yes on August 2nd. She politely said that she didn't think I wanted to talk to her, so I thanked her, I wished her a good day, and I started to leave. As I was leaving the doorstep, then I heard a woman inside start yelling and screaming at me, and as I was turned around walking back in her driveway, then she came out of the house, started yelling, and then pushed me with both hands and started hitting me with her fists. When I got to the end of her driveway, then she threw a dinner roll in my face and saying things like, "I hope you get raped. I hope you get run over by a car." And she continued to yell at me until I was further down the street. And she turned around and started to go back inside.
This lady was pro-choice, I assume. So if she's pro-woman and pro-choice, but why would she attack a woman just for having a different opinion?
You know, sadly, we are seeing a tremendous increase in violence against pro-lifers, where these abortion supporters are now pairing their advocacy with the violence for the violence of abortion with violent acts against pro-lifers.
It's rage is what it is. I mean, if you are, you know, pro-woman, why would you do that? I often wonder, too, did she press charges against this woman? How to respond to somebody like that? And to that final note there, we are seeing a real spike. They're seeing an uptick, an increase in attacks against these centers that are out there to help women who find themselves in a crisis pregnancy. It's unfortunate. You know, Representative Fred Keller from Pennsylvania, he submitted a report on this pro-abortion violence and the threats to the congressional record in July. Just listen to what he had to say.
Following the Dobbs ruling, pro-life organizations, especially churches, have become scenes of vandalism and violence. On June 7th, the Department of Homeland Security issued a National Terrorism Advisory System bulletin warning faith-based institutions of expected threats of violence in the coming months. The FBI issued a safety report regarding Jane's Revenge, the same domestic terrorist organization responsible for posting flyers around D.C. that read, "The night SCOTUS overturns Roe v. Wade, hit the streets. You said you'd riot to our oppressors. If abortions aren't safe, you're not either." Since Dobbs' decision leaked on May 2nd, over 100 pro-life institutions have been recipients of threats, desecration, vandalism, and arson. I ask unanimous consent to submit a list for the record from Susan B. Anthony, Pro-Life America, outlining recent violence.
Without objection.
All right, there again, that was the voice and the statement of Representative Fred Keller from Pennsylvania. You know, other people who need prayer really are these individuals attacking pro-life centers. I know we're called to forgive. We really are. We are called. In fact, there was one pro-life center, and I wish I remember the name of it. I either saw this yesterday or this morning and all the materials I was going through that actually forgave the person that attacked their center. And it's hard, isn't it? Isn't it hard? Has somebody hurt you, vandalized your property, betrayed you, lied about you, maybe filed false claims against you, victimized you, raped you, molested you? How do you forgive? How do you forgive somebody who perpetrates evil on you, attacks you like this young woman was attacked? It's hard. You know, and I always pray to God, please don't put me to the test. I see these parents forgiving the murderers of their children. You know, you know, you see these horrible acts that take place, and yet forgiveness wells up within the Christian heart. We are called to forgive. And when I see these stories, I often think, wow, that pro-life center that came out, that crisis pregnancy center, forgave the person that firebombed or destroyed or graffitied or whatever the situation was with their thing. And I just thought, praise God for that. What a beautiful example. It is love that transforms. It is love that converts. I was sharing with you the other day, I don't know if you caught my conversation, I was watching an old video from like the 1970s when the Cold War was raging. There was a former USSR defector. He was giving a presentation on how communism, Marxism, how the Soviet Union, how our enemies want to infiltrate our country, how they want to eradicate a religion, how they want to, infiltrate our levels of higher academia, how they want to indoctrinate. They go all the way, how they change terms. I mean, he went through this whole litany of things that we're seeing today, right? We're seeing it over and over again. And he shared a story in this piece he was talking about, and I was struck by it. He shared a story about a man who was, during the height of communism over there in the USSR, he was actually... He wasn't in Russia. This was a story about a man who was living in Brazil. He shared a story about a man who was down in Brazil. And after the Nazis, after Dr. Mengele, who was that doctor of death in the concentration camps, he'd experiment on human beings, torture them in unimaginable ways. A lot of these Nazi scientists and leaders, they escaped. They went to far regions of the planet. Many went to South America, in particular to Argentina, and this man was down there. And a young Argentinian boy at the time knew where the German conflicts were, where a lot of these Germans were living, and he snuck in. And apparently, he was held captive by none other than Dr. Mengele, who did experiments on him. And this boy also fell in love with a local girl who was there that was in this same type of prison, and or camp or whatever you want to call it. And this kid... had his bones broken, he had surgeries, he was molested and raped. I mean, he was tortured psychologically and physically in all sorts of ways. It would break any human being. And he fell in love with this girl. And he says it was love that kept him going. So this reporter came down and was talking to him one day. And he made the comment about, wouldn't you just love to kill them? Wouldn't you love just to destroy every single one of them? You know, and... he says, no. He says, that is what will destroy me. He says, it was love. It was love that rescued me. If it wasn't for this woman that I loved and who loved me, who nursed me back to health, who got me through this, I would be dead today. And I have to forgive and I have to love. And I'm thinking, how do you do that? I mean, that's heroic virtue, isn't it? It's so outside of many of our frame of reference, right? Do you have the ability to forgive? Now, we haven't walked that walk, right? We haven't gone through that. We haven't done that at all. He eventually escaped the camp. What ended up happening was he had a friend that he grew up with that was in, I guess, local law enforcement. They were able to get a message out to him. And when they came in for some sort of delivery, he was able to get into this vehicle and escape. That's how his story ultimately came to light. But you know, that's what we're called to do. I see whether it's concentration camps, whether it's the Christmas massacre, whether it's Uvalde, whether it is, you know, victims who survived the horrors of Nazism or communism. You know, it's ultimately love that will heal you and free you and liberate you. And it is love that will convert your enemy. And that's what we're called to do. Christ did it from the cross. So I didn't mean to go off on a tangent there, but I was just thinking about these pro-life centers that are doing this. CatholicVote.com, they've been tracking these situations, and they actually found that the violence against many of these centers is on the rise. In fact, in all of last year, I think they're now seeing, I think one happened in all of last year after the Dobbs leak. We got about 62 in about 3 months. They started shortly after May 2nd. When Politico published that leaked draft of the Dobbs decision, overturned Roe, there were 11 attacks last month, 31 in June, including a firebombing. They've taken place in 26 states. And fortunately, pro-lifers are resilient, and the centers have not shut down. They continue to be there for these women in crisis. Even Compass Care, the Buffalo clinic that was fireburned, has reopened, and they're planning on expanding their footprint. So I'm a big supporter of pro-life causes. If you can pray for them, certainly do that. And if you can't, then certainly pray for them as well. I want to change gears, if I can. I want to talk to you about one other issue. I only have a few minutes here with you. We could talk all day. We got a lot to get into. And you're welcome to join me anytime, too. You can dial in 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. You know, back during the Obama administration, the Department of Health and Human Services, the HHS, they issued a rule saying that any healthcare provider, they have to treat anyone who comes to them claiming to be transgender. And, you know, we're not just talking about treating them for flu or for, you know, broken leg or something like that. Whatever treatment the transgender person wanted to make him or her feel like a her or him, you know what I'm talking about, right? They had to perform. The healthcare provider had to do it. They absolutely had to, do it. Obviously, there are problems with that, including the fact that doctors have to use their best medical judgment, and they're just to do it. You know, not there, just do whatever the patients want them to do. But of course, there's also the issue of conscience. There are doctors who, for medical reasons and reasons of conscience, don't go along with that whole craziness, right? That whole transgender craziness. Fortunately, Beckett, they came to their rescue. They actually got the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals to stop this rule. Well, now the HHS is trying to put the rule back in place. So the secretary there, HHS Secretary Becerra, Xavier Becerra, who I often want to remind you is a Catholic. Please pray for his conversion. Is once again trying to resurrect it. So Franciscan Alliance has sued him. There's a hearing tomorrow in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans to try to, to try and permanently restrain it. I've invited today Monse Alvarado to stop by just to give us some perspective on that. Monse is the Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of Beckett, and they're a great group. Check them out at beckettlaw.org, and she stops by today just to give us some perspective on the significance of this case. Monse, thank you for your time. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
I am delighted. Now, look, I don't quite understand what Xavier Becerra is doing, to be honest with you. I mean, the Obama administration lost in court on the very same question. So, you know, why is he trying to do this again? I mean, what's the end goal here? What am I missing?
Well, you know, the reality is it's not a trying to do this again, and they never stopped doing it. So it's really great to think about the background. I was so grateful that you said that this had already been an ongoing court case, because it has been 5 years of Catholic universities, nursing programs, and nationwide hospital systems saying, no, I don't want to perform these services. I don't want to counsel for transgender transitions. That's not what I believe the human person was made to do. And that's part of, obviously, religious belief. But a lot of people forget that the medical science is here, too, where there is still a question about how these services, drugs, procedures, surgeries affect people in the long run. And why would you want to do that to someone when you don't really know what the outcome is going to be? That's the non-religious, non-faith inspired way to look at it. But you're right. This rule, the 1557 rule is what it's called, was created by the Obama administration on the eve of their administration. As they were on their way out, they tacked this on and said, hey, everyone has to provide transgender services and surgeries and procedures to children up to 12 years, as young as 12 years old, without parental consent.
Wow.
That's very scary, because you've seen a lot of stories around the country of different schools that are transitioning, in quotations, right, children without telling their parents. Your child comes home and says, Mom, I'm no longer a boy, I'm now a girl, and you have no clue what you have on your hands and who started it, right? Okay. It is quite problematic. So we do have two great victories at the Fifth Circuit and the Eighth Circuit stopping this rule, but we are in court again fighting the Biden administration, who has released a new version of this rule now. They've updated it. And contrary to what you might be hearing, it is not any better for religious people than it was originally.
So let's talk about that. Let's bring it home to people saying, well, this maybe really doesn't affect me. If the mandate goes into effect, what's it mean for religious health care systems? Because it's going to have a profound impact, and for individuals, those who work in those particular institutions. If they don't want to go along with this whole transgender craze, they say, hey, no. What's it mean for them? What's it mean for the institution?
It means that you're, as a doctor, you no longer have the ability to use your best medical judgment, right? You are forced to provide these services or walk away. in terms of hospital systems, they are fined in to the tune of, similar to the contraceptive mandate, to the tune of millions, billions, depending on the number of patients that they serve and how they decide to apply these fines. That's not determined yet, but I'm sure it will be soon. And also, you know, you're subject to losing any kind of partnership or federal grants that you receive already, which one in seven hospital beds is Catholic in this country.
Wow.
Don't think about the people who are serving, who you know are going to be and continue to be on the front lines of this. Think about the people, poor, disenfranchised, marginalized, who won't have access to medical care and are used to receiving great medical care from people who see them as human beings with great dignity, right?
Yeah.
I always think about those consequences. I know that us as believers, we're used to persecution. You know, our faith was built on the reality of persecution. But what about the people that need those services and they need those faith-inspired services that see them as people when the world no longer does, right? Pope Francis talks about the throwaway culture.
That's really well said. I'm glad you said that. I could not agree with you more. We have a moment or two left. Let me change gears for just a quick second on a different topic. Beckett has taken up a case from Seattle Pacific University. I'm sure you're familiar with it. It's a religious school where they will not hire teachers that are gay. And this is going to create, I think, a firestorm across the country. The short story is that the Washington State's Attorney General there intrusively demanded all kinds of documents from the school and its hiring practices, and the school's now suing on religious liberty grounds. It seems to me like an open and shut case, but fill us in on this, because as a Catholic, I look at what this might mean for Catholic institutions. You know, I think they're a Methodist organization there, but fill us in on the details of the story and how wide-reaching this can be.
Yes, so Seattle Pacific has been guided by its Christian mission and purpose, which is something I think that your listeners are very familiar with, for over 130 years. This idea of history and tradition of commitment to excellence inspired by your Christian faith and your mission, right? You want your students to do well because they have a vibrant understanding of who they are and who they're supposed to be in the world, embodying that mission, learning about that belief so they can share it with others. That was not the subject of a lawsuit by SPU. Seattle Pacific didn't sue the government. The government came in and targeted them, saying, I want every single copy of confidential information related to your employees and your university policies. Full stop. That is very scary when you get a notification like that from the attorney general saying, I want this. I'm starting an investigation on you. They had no other choice but to sue to protect themselves from such an intrusive way of forcing them to justify their religious identity.
Great.
That's a very scary thing for people of faith when you think about, like you said, how it applies to Catholic institutions. Sure, how it applies to groups around the country who just want to come together, to pray together, to learn together, whatever it is, whether you're religious or not. Now the government is going to set a precedent saying, I get to take a look at why you do what you do and how you make decisions.
Yeah.
So that's the first piece that I think is particularly scary in this case.
So where do you see all this going in the end? I mean, so many of these different cases, where's the needle moving in the culture? Are we becoming more accepting of this? Is this still just as abhorrent to most Americans, yet there's a particular sector of the population that says, oh, no, this is fine, this is normal, we want to make this a human rights issue? I mean, how do you see all this playing out?
You know, a lot of people make the mistake of thinking that this is about, same-sex or LGBTQ rights versus religious freedom in the press, I would say. But the reality is a plurality of Americans believe, so most Americans believe that Christian ministries and institutions with Christian missions or even any kind of religious missions, right? You have Muslim and Jewish universities as well, should be allowed to carry out their mission without government intervention, without government telling them what to believe. So America is really, really good at this. You only hear the bad stories, but the Supreme Court is also really good at this. And some people like to say that it's this new Supreme Court that's good at this. No, 9-0, about 12 years ago, you got a great decision from the Supreme Court saying that institutions should be allowed to hire and fire according to mission. So that was that's Ginsburg, Kagan, voting for something like this, 9-0, wholeheartedly. So I would give you that to encourage you, but also to let you know that what we're hearing on TV, these stories, this kind of targeting, it's un-American, it's uncivil, and we're going to win in court.
Amen to that. Let's grab a quick call for you. I only have about a minute or two left. Tom's in California joining us. Tom, good afternoon. You're on the air with Monse Alvarado.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I just wanted to say, last night on the Jesse Waters show on Fox News, Tulsi Gabbard was saying that the FDA doesn't even approve of these hormones that they give the kids to change their gender, the teenagers that they force them on and that they want to give them. And the Biden administration and the Biden Kamala Harris administration wants to force these. They want to, they're really pushing it. And the bad thing about it is really bad for the kids and bad for their health. And the FDA doesn't approve of it. Before we were talking about we got to follow the science, we got to follow the CDC, we got to follow the FDA. Now it's like, the heck with that. They're pushing it on us. And it used to be only like maybe 1%. It wasn't even a big thing, you know, this transgenderism. And I don't think it has anything to do with discrimination because most of the time there's, you know, if somebody's doing that and they're an adult, you feel sorry for them, you pray for them, so on and so forth.
Right. Tom, let me hold you on just on that thought because I'm really up against the clock. I want to give Monse the final thoughts for you. So, Monse, I'll give you the floor.
Thank you. You know, he's completely right. Transgender procedures, there's great widespread debate about them. But the reality here is that the government shouldn't be making those decisions for doctors, and they definitely shouldn't be making those decisions for people of faith. So prayer is definitely both for the case and for the administration to change their mind about the way that they're treating believers.
Well, Monse, I want to thank you for the great work that you are doing. Keep up the incredible efforts there at Beckett. And if people want to follow you or get connected to the work that Beckett does, it's beckettlaw.org. Is that the best way to connect?
Yes, it is, beckettlaw.org.
Well, we'll do it. Hey, we'll talk again soon, I hope. I always appreciate the time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
That's Monse Alvarado, Vice President, Chief Operating Officer of Beckett. As I said, really a wonderful organization fighting for liberty and upholding some very fundamental truths. When I return, we'll change gears. I want to talk about legalizing marijuana. Last month, several Democratic senators introduced a bill called the Cannabis Administration and Opportunity Act. I don't know if you heard about this or not. I'll get you plugged in. Stay with me.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Oh, I love that. That bumper. Mary Jane, right? We're going to be talking about the Mary Jane. We're going to talk about a little marijuana coming up here in a moment. It's good to be here with you today. Thanks for joining me. You know, before we get into that subject, I just want to remind you of something. I heard Father Simon talk about it earlier, so I'll put a quick exclamation point on that. I don't know if you have a will or whether or not you're among 71% of Americans who don't. It's a pretty big number. Almost 3 out of 4 people don't have a will. Or maybe you have one there. It's outdated. Relevant Radio is actually partnered with an organization called Free Will, and they're going to provide you with a very easy, very intuitive online service that, well, you can use to create your will at zero cost. I know that's a big thing. Putting a will together normally costs you, you know, at least 4 figures, right? It's over $1,000, $1,500, a couple grand. I don't know. It's up there, but this is free. So you can make your will today in about 20 minutes. Just go to relevantradio.com/freewill. Again, relevantradio.com/freewill. And you can check it out there. Speaking of marijuana, let me tell you what's happening here. We've been following this ever since there's been a movement across the country to decriminalize marijuana. We've talked about whether there are benefits or you know, whether benefits to it or whether or not it's harmful for you. Back during the Obama administration, the HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, they issued this rule saying that any healthcare provider, they have to treat anyone who comes to them. I'm zoning out right now on the issue. My mind just went totally blank. Let me pick it up again. The bill I'm thinking of, as I said before the break, is called the Cannabis Administration Opportunity Act, not the HHS. And what this was, it was a bill that would remove the drug from the controlled substance list and give states the power to pass their own laws on it. And of course, you know, a lot of states have already done that, starting in Colorado in 2013. And I think attitudes on marijuana are changing in the country. I don't know about you. There are a lot of states where it now has become decriminalized and even legal. And I can't tell you how many people I know now that smoke really on a very regular basis. And a lot of people's attitudes now are that, yeah, it's not that bad. Let's decriminalize it. Let's legalize it, right? In fact, there's been legalization bills that have been introduced. Now, whether they're for medical or recreational marijuana, all of them passed. In fact, 18 states in Washington, D.C. have all legalized recreational marijuana. And I think we're going to see this go across the country. I think it'll be state by state by state. But the House has already passed its own version of a similar bill. And we've talked about this, you know, I think it was maybe a month ago, 2 months ago. The Senate bill is different than the House version. If it were passed, you know, if it were to pass the Senate, there'd have to be, you know, a conference committee on the issue. But getting it passed in the Senate, I personally, from where I sit, I think it's tough. Democrats are going to need, I think, 10 Republican senators to go along with them. And that probably, it might be a tough threshold. But then again, I could be wrong on this. I don't know where they sit on that particular issue. I don't know where you sit. I'd love to hear your take on it. Look, it's not just legalization that has happened. There was a piece in the Washington Examiner. And the Washington Examiner made the case that Washington, D.C. has gone so far as to prohibit employers in the city, with some exceptions, from citing marijuana use or positive drug tests as justification for either firing or rejecting an application or even punishing. That's a tough one. I think if you're an employer and you don't want your employee, right, to be smoking marijuana, I get it. I get it. And if you want to reject an application because somebody does, I think an employer should have that right. There are exceptions that include, you know, federal workers, because marijuana is still, you know, it's against federal law. But the Examiner, they made the case that the Senate bill would decriminalize marijuana. It would expunge all criminal records. It would remove marijuana from the list of controlled substances, establish a minimum age to purchase marijuana. I wonder what that would be, 18, 21? I don't know. Younger, 16? I don't know. It would allow some health workers to recommend medical marijuana, too. So one of our experts on this, somebody we go to a lot, just for perspective on if these things become reality, and they very well may be, what's the long-term impact of this, and how does it affect you? I've invited Luke Niforatos. He is the executive vice president of Smart Approaches to Marijuana, and easy website to remember. You can go online and learn about SAM.org. That's SAM.org. Learn about SAM.org. And Luke, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Hey, Drew. It's great to be back. God bless you, man. Hope you're well.
I am well, and God bless you. Where are we as a country? Let me start there. Are attitudes changing? There was a time where people thought, oh, you know, marijuana should never be legal. And now we have multiple states on board. More people are smoking. More people are using CBD. I mean, it's... Has the threshold been lowered? Are attitudes changing? Are you going to see more states kind of, you know, fall in line with the states that have already legalized or decriminalized marijuana?
Yeah, great question. So obviously, we're all hearing about in the news, the media, we're hearing about some of the different states that have legalized marijuana. We're still far less than half of the states in this country have legalized it. I think there's kind of this perception out there that, oh, everyone's done it. But we're only at about 17 states that have chosen to legalize recreational marijuana. So, you know, not nothing, but certainly not a large portion of the country yet. And I think, you know, what we're seeing is certainly, you know, as far as public perception goes, you know, no doubt about it, people have a more permissive attitude toward marijuana. And I think that's largely because of the media that's out there, you know, celebrities who, by the way, are multimillionaires and can get away with sitting around getting stoned in their mansion all day and night. Unlike the rest of the 99% of us who can't afford to do something like that, but that's neither here nor there. But, you know, we see celebrities out there saying it's okay. And, you know, obviously that message is trickling down to our kids and to our generations in this country. So, you know, that is happening. But what I will say is, you know, we're not in a situation where legalization is inevitable. We have a number of states, dozens of states every year that reject the legalization of marijuana, that, you know, don't want it in their state. You know, obviously the vast majority of the country has not legalized it. And, you know, you look at the Senate bill that was introduced, Senator Schumer, and, you know, he introduced a federal marijuana legalization bill last week, and only five senators, a grand total of only five out of 100 senators have signed on to that bill for legalization. So not a lot of momentum for that. And you need at least 60 votes to be able to pass a bill through the Senate. So it's just really interesting. You look at the dynamics. I don't think we're going to be seeing federal legalization anytime soon. Obviously, we'll continue to see that fight at the state level. I'm from Colorado. We were the first state to legalize marijuana. And, you know, we've seen a whole lot of, you know, we've had legalization for about 9 years. And people are really starting to realize all the problems that it created with the commercialization, with what happened to the drug, a lot of the studies that are coming out now on the mental illness side of things and black market. There's a lot of unintended consequences that I think come out of these policy decisions.
Is driving a huge issue in Colorado? I know, people get DUIs for all sorts of reasons, but has that increased the amount of people driving under the influence?
Yes, 100%. Actually, there was a research study that just came out last week in the Journal on Drugs and Alcohol, a very prominent journal, and they found significant increases in not only the rate of car crashes from marijuana-impaired drivers in legal states, but also the rate of people dying from marijuana-impaired drivers on the roads in legal states. So that was just the latest of a whole string of studies. There were studies by AAA, one of the largest car insurance companies in America. Yep. Whole bunch of other research bodies out there have confirmed this trend of once a state legalizes marijuana, more people die on the roads from marijuana-impaired drivers. That's just a fact. It's a huge problem. It doubled in Colorado, doubled in Washington State after those states legalized marijuana. So driving is a huge, huge problem. And the one thing I will say about this is, we don't even have a scientifically validated roadside test for marijuana like we do for alcohol. Doesn't exist. Right. We also don't have a 0.08 limit to determine impairment for marijuana like we do for alcohol. So, we are decades in terms of the science away from these kinds of standards. And so it's a little crazy to be pushing for legalization when we don't even know how to test for it on the roadside.
You talk about the dangers of the road. I think as an employer, if, say you're in the state of Illinois, marijuana is legal there, or whatever state you want to go to, Colorado, et cetera. I think an employer should still have the right to tell its employees, I don't want you coming high. I don't want the THC in your system. I mean, whether they're working, on machinery or whether they're doing something else. As I was sharing that, Washington Examiner was reporting that D.C.'s gone so far as to prohibit employers in the city, with some exceptions regarding, whether or not you can reject or fire somebody for being under the influence or having smoked marijuana. What do you make of that? I mean, I think that goes a little far.
Yes, it's extreme. It's crazy. But there, D.C. is not the only place that's doing it. Nevada became the first state to ban employers from rejecting job applicants over testing positive for marijuana. New York City's city council did that as well. A number of other states have done this that have legalized marijuana. And what it comes down to is, once you legalize marijuana, you commercialize it. You create this industry. This industry is funded by Big Tobacco. They've got more than $2 billion in investments from Altria, which is a new name for Philip Morris. They've got more than $4 billion in investments from Constellation Brands, which is the largest alcohol conglomerate in the country. So they're invested in by these big predatory industries that are already hurting a lot of people and targeting a lot of underprivileged communities already. And what they start doing is lobbying to reduce the regulations, lobbying to normalize their drug. And so what's happening with marijuana is they get legalized in a state, and then the first thing they do is try to protect marijuana use as a protected class with employers. So what that means is they try to argue that it's basically discrimination to hold an employee liable or fire or not hire an employee for using marijuana, regardless of, and for example, in Nevada, there are no exceptions. Like if you're a bus driver or a pilot of a plane or a surgeon, you can use marijuana and you can't be fired for it, which is just terrible, because the research tells us that, when you're using any drug, but certainly marijuana, it impairs your ability to do your job correctly. And of course, it impairs your ability to drive if you're a bus driver. So this is a trend we're seeing from the industry to push this drugs normalization into the workplace. And I think it's going to be very destructive.
Well, let me do this. I need to take just a short pause. When we come back, I want to ask you about a bill that passed in California. And everyone needs to hear about this, a place where people can shoot up heroin, actually heroin. Wait till you hear this story, what California is now doing. My guest today is Executive Vice President of Smart Approaches to Marijuana, Luke Nefaratos. If you want to join us, I literally only have him for a few minutes. You can get in, though, right now at 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Chapel of Divine Mercy is also about 15 minutes away. We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/Forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
The Chaplet of Divine Mercy begins soon on Relevant Radio.
Hey, thanks for joining me. Yeah, we'll pray coming up in just a few moments. Let's pray for our country, right? Let's pray for so much of the confusion that seems to have overcome it. It really has. I'm joined today by Luke Niferato. So if you're just joining us, he's Executive Vice President for Smart Approaches to Marijuana. They're online at learnaboutsam.org if you want to learn a little bit more. We'll take a few of your calls. We're talking about marijuana. There's a lot going on right now. As I was sharing, the House passed its own bill. The Senate bill is a little different than the House version. And we're talking about what will happen if this thing passes. And Nick, you know, outside of marijuana, I want to get to one other issue. We can always go back to this and take a few calls. I do want to talk about something that's happening in California. And I just saw a piece today that talked about it establishing funding for places where people can go and safely, and I use the word very loosely, shoot up heroin. I don't know what they're thinking. I had a friend who did time in jail for an addiction he had, and heroin was part of that battle. You know, if somebody is struggling with heroin, put them on Suboxone. Put them on something other than the drug itself. That person will never find freedom from it if you constantly pump that junk into their system. What's going on in California? What's the rationale behind this? I don't quite get it.
Yeah, great question, Drew. And this is just, again, it's the result of allowing, you know, a lax attitude toward drugs, just this idea that drugs are no big deal. Now what's taking hold or what they're attempting to push, advocates are attempting to push, is this idea that drugs can be used safely. And there are whole organizations designated to that we could spend a long time talking about, Drew. But basically what's happening in L.A. is in California, is they have passed a bill that's going to go to the governor to sign. It's on the governor's desk right now, that would create what's called, quote unquote, supervised injection sites or quote unquote, safe injection sites. And so basically the idea is, folks are addicted to, you know, for example, heroin. They can go to this, place. They can get their drug injected under the supervision of a doctor or some sort of physician. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is considered to be better than, trying to get them treatment or other things because they claim some people just will never get free from their addiction. And so really what this comes down to is a fundamental philosophical difference in worldviews. Okay, so the worldview behind safe injection sites is there are people who are always going to be slaves to addiction, and we should just try to get them their drug as safely as we can, which just crazy. So everyone's aware, you can't use heroin or any drug safely. Okay, no. But that's what they're saying. So people don't overdose and just let people continue with their addiction and maybe get help if they decide. Then there's the worldview that says we are all capable of doing great things. We are innately created by our creator to have a purpose in this world, and we can be set free from any chains of bondage. And so people deserve that investment and that time, whether it's through treatment, through counseling, whatever, those interventions to help them get off their addiction. And so it's really a war between those two things when it comes to supervised injection sites. Gotcha. And so it's really crazy, but basically what it comes down to is, you know, government-sanctioned drug use, which is really a huge problem. There's no proof that these things even work.
Yeah, it's wild. Luke, let me grab a quick call here before I run out of time with you. George is listening in Modesto, California. George, you're on the air with Luke Niferatos. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. First, I have a comment on medical marijuana. It's just a back door to make everything recreational. And the reason I say that is if it is really medical marijuana, why do they have to smoke it? Why can't they take a pill prescribed by a doctor? So that's my opinion. So, and then the second thing is because it's of the recreational part or whatever they smoke, is that going to be treated like cigarettes to keep people away in a restaurant or at work a certain distance or... Because secondhand smoke is a big problem for, as we know, for cigarettes, and now marijuana, you can get high once you get a secondhand smoke. Is it? Yeah. Can you get high?
George, thank you. Great call. Luke, I'm going to let you respond.
So was the question, you know, how is this medical because you can't take a pill? Or I just want to make sure I fully understood the question.
There were two parts. The first was a point. He's saying, hey, you know, if recreational marijuana is a medical marijuana is a doorway to recreational marijuana, was what he was saying. If you really want it for those medical purposes rather than smoking, why don't you just take a pill? The second point that he brought up was, you know, hey, when it came to secondhand cigarette smoke, we know what nicotine does. We know what exposure to that does. Is the same applicable when it comes to marijuana, and is there the chance of getting high?
Yes. So to the first point, you're absolutely right. They do, you know, put marijuana in all different kinds of forms, but it's not medical. We don't vote on our medicines. The quote-unquote medical marijuana you see out there is sold by companies. It's the same marijuana as recreational marijuana. It's just called something different. So you are 100% right about that. It's not safe. It hasn't gone through clinical trials. It's not regulated by science. So yes, medical marijuana out there is a total marketing ploy and nothing more. To your second point, it's a great question. Secondhand tobacco smoke, as we know, has lots of carcinogens and other things in it. Secondhand marijuana smoke, according to the American Lung Association, has the exact same carcinogenic effects. So the smoke we get from the smoke you inhale from marijuana smoke, it's the same kind of damaging effects. So we really do need to look at it as the same kind of public health issue.
Well, look, we'll continue to follow what's happening in Congress and in the Senate and across the country. And I hope people will check out your resources at learnaboutsam.org. I'm grateful for your time. Keep up your good work, and thanks for joining us.
Yep. Thank you, Drew. God bless you. Have a great day.
God bless you. That's Luke Niforatos, Executive Vice President of Smart Approaches to Marijuana. We've got about 4 minutes or so before we stop, and then we'll pray the chaplet. I'm grateful for Luke. My colleague, Patrick Alog, who's a pretty big sports fan, notified me of something I didn't know. Vince Scully died. Let me open the mic. Patrick, why don't you join me here quickly, if you don't mind. Open your mic. Hey, good to have you with me.
Yeah.
So fill us in on his life, his legacy. I know my colleague, former colleague, Joe Sikora, he sent me a text earlier today saying he actually prayed the rosary in his home for Catholic Athletes for Christ, and he's got some great stories to share. Fill everyone in who may not know him.
Absolutely. Vince Scully is one of the greatest, not just baseball sportscasters of all time, but one of the greatest sportscasters and probably people in broadcast media in general. He was an incredible wordsmith. And even if you're not a baseball fan, you definitely have heard his voice somewhere out there. And he was a broadcaster. He started in the 50s, right even before Willie Mays and Mickey Mantle. So he started his career way back when. And then he was known... he moved over to LA with the Dodgers, so a lot of people in our California markets, Southern California markets, definitely knew of him as well. And for someone like me who grew up as a big sports fan and who wanted to be in sports casting as well, he was a big idol of mine. And also, he talked a lot about his faith. And at the time of during his life, unfortunately, his wife died and his son died as well. And he talked about his devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary. And he said this, he encouraged devotion to the Virgin Mary, saying her prayers are more powerful than those of the rest of heaven combined. No one was closer or more devoted to Christ on earth. So it only makes sense to see the same thing in heaven. Now she seeks to help her spiritual children get home to spend eternity with her son. And now he is doing that as well.
Yeah, now I understand you grabbed some audio of
yes.
this going?
And here is his final words that he spoke during his final game in 2016.
You know, friends, so many people have wished me congratulations on a 67-year career in baseball, and they've wished me a wonderful retirement with my family. And now, all I can do is tell you what I wish for you. May God give you for every storm a rainbow, for every tear a smile, for every care a promise, and a blessing in each trial. For every problem life seems, a faithful friend to share. For every sigh, a sweet song and an answer for each prayer. You and I have been friends for a long time, but I know in my heart that I've always needed you more than you've ever needed me. And I'll miss our time together more than I can say. But you know what? There will be a new day and eventually a new year. And when the upcoming winter gives way to spring, rest assured, once again, it will be time for Dodger baseball. So this is Vin Scully wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon wherever you may be.
Wow. Well, Patrick, thank you.
You're welcome, thank you
for the insight and for that clip. And let's pray for the repose of the soul of Vince Scully. May he rest in peace. The Chaplet of Divine Mercy is coming up in just about 60 seconds. If you want to get in, you have a need, an intention, a desire, you need some extra prayer, here's how you do it. It's 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149, and I'll do my best to get as many calls on the air as I can. If you would like to send us your prayer intentions as well, you can do that on our Twitter page, at Drew Mariani Show. Maggie, my producer, will be monitoring that. She'll bring some of those to the air. So you may not get through on the phone lines, but Maggie can voice your intention, and maybe I'll even share a few answered prayers. We'll pray for Vince, for his family. Let's pray for those who mourn. Let's pray for our country, for the great disorientation that we are experiencing today. This diabolic disorientation is what we are experiencing. I'm such a believer that prayer changes things, and I've got great hope for the future of this country and for what God has in store for you. We cannot let fear dominate. In fact, maybe I come back, I'll address that issue of fear. Stay with me. The Chaplet of Divine Mercy is straight ahead.